ready to rise above loud, angry headlines, longing for an alternative to the world's fighting and fear-mongering? Christianity Today magazine offers a trustworthy, faithful perspective on stories that matter to you, from the church next door to movements and ministries all around the world. Subscribe to CT for full access to in-depth reporting, insightful commentary, and redemptive storytelling, both online and in print. A subscription to CT also includes seasonal devotionals, special issues, and exclusive content. Visit orderct.com today or click the link in the show notes to get started and join a growing community of thoughtful evangelical Christians who value different news that makes a difference. That's orderct.com to subscribe today. We spend a lot of time on podcasts like this predicting the future in various ways. But as we do that, we know life is really unpredictable. And as the scripture says, we do not know the number of our days. And that's why it's a really important thing to have a will, to protect yourself and your family. Christianity Today has partnered with Epic Will to walk you through the entire process of creating a will in as little as 10 minutes. You don't have to have a law degree to be able to walk through this, and that's why it's really helpful. So visit morect.com, that's morct.com, will, that's morect.com/will to get started today. Welcome to the Russell Moore Show, brought to you by Christianity Today. I'm your host, the editor-in-chief at Christianity Today, and this is the place where we explore conversations and questions from a Christian perspective. And this is one of those times when we're dealing with your questions. So before we get to your questions, and I'm going to use the word questions too much right now, but send me your questions to questions@russellmoore.com. We won't use your name unless you tell us to, because a lot of these questions are going to be really personal. People don't want that broadcast, and so we understand that. So send it to questions@russellmoore.com. First question I have is, Dr. Moore, do you have any exciting news for us? And the answer to that is yes. I would like to introduce you to the new producer of The Russell Moore Show, Ashley Hales. Ashley is a PhD in English literature from University of Edinburgh. When with her husband, she is the co-founder of the Willowbrae Institute, which is a new think tank dealing with the intersection of Christianity and the common good here in North America. And she hosts her own podcast, and has authored the book Finding Holy in the Suburbs and the book A Spacious Life. And you can find more about her in the show notes. And I'm really glad to have Ashley with us. She's going to be especially visible to you when we have these questions, conversations. Ashley, welcome aboard.
Thank you. It's such a privilege and honor to be here. Thanks.
Well, we have a good time here, and especially because this is the best time of the year. I will fight anyone on that fall is the best time of the year. And I think I have almost a reverse seasonal affective disorder. Mm-hmm. Where the fall invigorates me. So I'm really excited to start this process.
Yes, it's very exciting. I think, you know, as we have just recently been through midterm elections, so whenever election season comes up, Christians can struggle to know what to do. So what's the process by which we can decide how we cast our ballots as Christians? Help us like work through that ethically. How do we decide when it's appropriate, when it's not appropriate? What do we do if neither candidate really embodies Christian ethics? Help us think through that.
Well, I often would say in years past, election years make Christians go crazy. And I've sort of modified that because I look back at my past self saying that and saying, oh, Bambi, you were so naive. You had no idea what was actually coming down the pike. And what has changed is that elections now make almost everybody go crazy. Mm-hmm. And we're never out of it. And so the fact that there is no time when we can say, okay, we're out of an election season. We just came out of midterms. We're right into the 2024 presidential election. A lot of families and churches haven't even healed up from the 2016 presidential election, and we're headed into 2024. So what I would say is the way that voting works in our system. Think about it almost the way you would in terms of doing a job interview and the sort of person that you're going to hire. Mm-hmm. And so people know, I said in 2016 and have said consistently since, character matters in terms of public office, no matter whether the person we're talking about is on your side, quote unquote, or not on your side. But sometimes people will say, well, does that mean that to take some of the obvious, really extreme situations that we have seen or may see, and look at just a kind of a normal, for whatever that is now, normal kind of election, does that mean that I need to vote for somebody who is a Christian? And the answer to that is, I think, no. But that you do need to vote for somebody on the basis of qualifications to lead, but also on the basis of character, the character of that person, as best as you can see. And again, think about it in terms of the in terms of a job interview, because someone said one time to me, well, that's inconsistent. If you say that character matters, but you're willing to vote for a Latter-day Saint or a Jewish person or someone else who's not a Christian, that's not consistent. Well, of course it is. I mean, if you're wanting to hire somebody to work in your hardware store, might you hire somebody who doesn't share your religious beliefs? Well, of course. You're going to be hiring all kinds of people who don't share your religious beliefs. But if somebody, you're interviewing somebody and their last employer says, yeah, this is somebody who does the job well, but does a lot of sexually harassing of other people. No, you don't want that person. Or if they say, you know, this is a good enough kind of person, but is a disaster at the job, you're not going to want to hire that person either. Now, can you be surprised? Of course, there are going to be candidates who are going to seem to have the character and the qualifications who later you're going to find out that this person was a fraud or this person was incompetent. That's going to happen in every arena of life. It's going to happen when somebody's being hired in a workplace. There might be things you don't know and you can't see, but when you can see them, then you need to be very concerned about that. And I'm probably more worried about this issue of voting than I ever have before, because voting right now has become less about actually getting things done and tribal identity. Who's going to win? And if we win, we win it all.
Yeah.
And we're exuberant. And if we lose, we've lost it all. So there's a kind of catastrophism that can be put out that can then give you, you can feel like that means you've got to absorb into your tribe wholly.
Yeah.
Or else you're going to be destroyed, and that's a really, really dangerous place to be. And we're at a very precarious place in this system of government that we have of liberal democracy, and we shouldn't take it for granted. And I think there are a lot of people who think, oh, just the sort of craziness that we have going on right now, it's just, we're just having fun. We're just celebrating life or what have you, and don't realize just how fragile this system actually is, and don't realize kind of what that's doing to you. And so I think that having all of that, but I mean, this questioner, the very fact that he or she is sort of asking this question tells me to some degree they haven't been swept into that.
Right.
And so I would say just don't be swept into that.
Yes. That's a wonderful, just don't jump on the crazy train, right?
Don't jump on the crazy train. Yes. Yeah. And if you're on it, you can get off.
Yes.
But the problem is a lot of times you don't know that you're on the crazy train.
That is a good point.
It's hard to know because now what happens is you can curate your life.
Right.
In terms of social media, in terms of other forms of media, in terms of just friendships and relationships, where you're in this ecosystem where things start to look normal to you that actually aren't.
Right. Yeah. And so this next question from a listener actually dovetails nicely with that. He's asking you just for some clarity about how we might begin to define this idea of Christian nationalism.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
So I think maybe just some that, you know, that term has been in the news and the headlines, and he's just really a little bit unclear about what that means and what our duties are to our nation and how we might understand that term.
Well, Christian nationalism is the use of Christian symbols or ideas for the purpose of ethnic or national identity. So you can see Christian nationalism kind of on a spectrum here. And so look at, for instance, the way that you see it in Europe, where you will have ethno-nationalist groups that are, when they use Christian, they're saying, you know, we need to be Christians. And what they really mean by that is we need to be French, or we need to be German, or we need to be Hungarian, or whatever it is. And that means that we're not Muslim, or we're not Jewish, or we're not something else. And then you see the way that that has shown up in the United States of America, where religion is used for that kind of usually white identity sort of politics. And so sometimes it's really interesting how Christian nationalists approach this, because at first when this conversation started happening and some of us started saying, watch this and be warned about this, it was, oh, well, there's no such thing as Christian nationalism. That's just made up, and what it refers to is any person who, anybody who's a Christian who's involved in the public square.
Right.
No, that's not what Christian nationalism is. And it's not somebody whose conscience is shaped and formed by Christianity, which has implications for how, that's not what it is either. But a lot of these people say, oh, well, there isn't any such thing. And then they started saying, well, even if there is, it's not so bad. And then that moved to, yeah, Christian nationalism, let's get on board with that.
Yeah.
And so that process just is working itself out. Now, sometimes people say, well, how do I know what Christian nationalism is as opposed to just being a Christian and having normal patriotism?
Right.
Well, patriotism is the equivalent of honoring father and mother, loving family, having gratitude for the place around you. It's a good and right thing to love your country. But go back and read George Orwell about the difference between patriotism and nationalism, having seen this up close in Germany and Italy and everywhere else. I think Orwell is right about that definition, that it's not just affection for one's country and service to one's country. It's a tribal kind of identity. And the reason that I'm concerned about Christian nationalism is, first of all, because I think it's horribly dangerous to the kind of American experiment that we have, that came from a lot of, especially in my ancestral tradition, Baptists, saying we don't want the government using the church in order to do what they want to do. Mm-hmm. But more importantly, I believe in hell. I really believe that Jesus Christ is the way, the truth, and the life, and that no one comes to the Father except through him. And that is through faith, personal faith, and repentance. We don't come before the judgment seat of Christ nation by nation or ethnicity by ethnicity or family by family or even church by church. We come one by one. And once you replace that with some sort of external conformity, which is what Christian nationalism does, then you've actually denied the gospel of Jesus Christ, because you're one birth short of what the gospel actually is. Mm-hmm. And you are using and misusing the name of Christ in a way that takes the name of the Lord your God in vain. I mean, you think about that third commandment. It's not, you know, I grew up in a home where it wasn't my parents, but we had some relatives who would, anytime you said, gosh darn it, or, you know, that was sort of the Southern Baptist cussing we had. You couldn't do that. Well, that's not really what taking the name of Lord your God in vain is about. It's about using the name of God and using the authority of God in a way that God has not commanded. And that's what Christian nationalism does. So when somebody says, well, how do I know if what I'm getting into, you really can't know what's Christian nationalism or not. Well, sure you can. I mean, think of white nationalism.
Yep.
If maybe you're a white person and you love your country, somebody says to you, are you white? Yes. Do you love your country? Are you a patriot? Yes. Are you a white nationalist? No. If someone says to you, are you a Christian? Yes. Do you love your country? Yes. Are you a Christian nationalist? No. Because you're not taking your faith and absorbing it into this really predatory, and actually, you know, Christian nationalism is very right-wing. And so it appears to be conservative on the surface, but it's actually liberalism theologically, because it's the exact definition of what J. Gresham Machen talked about in Christianity and Liberalism, where he said when you're using Christianity as a means to an end, no matter what the end is, this is no longer Christianity. Mm-hmm. That's what Christian nationalism is.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. I know when we have a really busy week, when we have so many great things to do, but there's something on the calendar every day, my social battery can get totally depleted. It can be easy to ignore our social battery and to spread ourselves thin, especially with social gatherings picking up after the winter. And what's the right amount of socializing for you? How do you recharge? Maybe you thrive around people, or maybe you need some more alone time. Figuring out what we need on our own can be challenging. Therapy can give you the self-awareness to understand your needs and build a social life that doesn't drain your battery. If you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's convenient, flexible, and easily fits into your social calendar. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/RussellMoore today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/RussellMoore. Yeah. Any thoughts on what do we do, those of us who are trying to stand against it, or, you know, find ourselves or our friends or neighbors, family members swept up into that? What might be a way forward?
Well, I think a lot of it is going to be small scale. Wendell Berry told a group of environmentalists one time, he said, the problem is people want a solution that is as large scale as the crisis, that's rarely the way that crises are actually confronted. It's with a lot of small scale solutions. So I would say the first thing is not to be swept up into it yourself. Recognize it for what it is and model something different. Mm-hmm. Have a different way of following Jesus. And a lot of that is about something as simple as watching your emotional kind of involvement when it comes to a lot of these cultural or political issues that what Christian nationalists are counting on is that those things will seem to be an emergency for you. And then they can come in and say, well, because it's an emergency, it means that the normal kinds of rules of fruit of the Spirit and Christian ethics and even the Christian gospel, those don't apply. So you can do that. And a lot of times you can see if you're moving in that direction just on the basis of what ultimately terrifies you. Is it judgment of God or is it what's happening around you in terms of some cultural panic? And what is it that ultimately brings you joy? I mean, we're in a time right now where the distinction between private and public, between what's real life and what's or normal, ordinary life and what's politics, that distinction's almost been completely obliterated. Yeah, everything's been politicized. And what that leaves you with is a politics of people who are hollowed out. I mean, it's an impersonal, what C.S. Lewis would talk about with these men without chests.
Yeah.
You're hollowed out. And so I think that, just watch that in yourself. And when it comes to talking to other people, and we're going to talk about this a lot because we get this question a lot.
Yep.
A lot of times it's going to depend on what is your relationship to the person.
Yeah.
And so there are some people in your life that you can say, hey, what are you doing?
Right.
And there are going to be other people that you kind of say, I'm going to go about this in a much, slower, more patient way.
Yeah. You know, I found even Friedman's concept of a non-anxious presence a helpful, you know, even just showing up as a non-anxious presence in an anxious system can be a way to show the gospel is actually changing you. You don't have to participate.
I mean, you look at Jesus, and one of the remarkable things about Jesus is the emotional reaction. Mm-hmm. So you have people trying to get Jesus into all of these disputes, and a lot of them were political disputes, right, in a way that was... it was means to an end. It was a way of getting him. So, for instance, with the Caesar's coin, if Jesus, they know that if Jesus says, pay the taxes to Caesar, he's saying David's throne is evacuated and the Romans are the legitimate occupiers of the land of promise. And if he says, don't pay the tax to Caesar, then he's an insurrectionist leading a rebellion against Rome. So either way, what Jesus does is to say, render to Caesar the things that are Caesar's and to God the things that are God's. And a lot of times we look at that and say, oh, well, what he's saying is give the things that you need to give to government and give the things that belong to God to God. That's true. He is saying that. But he's also handing the coin back and saying, whose picture is on that?
Yeah.
Caesar's. Give Caesar what's Caesar's. So he's not brought into that kind of emotional captivity to what's happening around him. And I think we need to guard that as well.
Yeah, that's wonderful. So here's another hard question from a listener. She's talking about suicide, and she has her niece ended up committing suicide, and there was a first attempt, and she prayed, and it didn't seem, she says, like God heard her, And the young woman, her niece, ended up taking her own life. And so years later, she's really unsure what faith looks like, you know, as she reflects on that issue and her own personal walk with God. She says, you know, how can I pray for other things with any real confidence that our loving Father will respond as we understand a loving Father would when it seems like he didn't save her relative?
Yeah. Well, I mean, first of all, what I would say is we have this way of thinking about suicide particularly that is not only not helpful, but is harmful. Yeah. So we think of suicide in this completely different way than we think about mental health generally. Yeah. What's happening in virtually every situation with someone who dies by suicide is a mental health emergency that is manifesting itself that way, where a person doesn't see any way to get out of their pain. And so we can know that's not the answer and that shouldn't happen, while at the same time knowing the person who is dying in this way, actually, they aren't themselves. Right. That's why they're at that point of desperation. They're suffering in that way, and so I think we have to understand that, and remove some of the shame that comes with survivors of people who have situations where people have died by suicide. A shame either in terms of, well, this person took her own life, and that's wrong to take a human life. That's right. It is wrong. But you have somebody who's not at a place of moral responsibility, usually. Mm-hmm. You have somebody who's in this place of desperation. But also kind of shame where people think, well, what did I do?
Right.
And what could I have done more? When the reality is there's nothing different that it's not as though this is about one conversation. This takes a lot more intervention than that. Yeah. And so take the guilt and the shame off of that. But when you come to the actual root of the question she's asking, it actually doesn't have to do with suicide as much as it has to do with the matter that we all face, which is, why is there evil and suffering in the world? I mean, that's ultimately the question. Why do horrible things happen? And why do my prayers aren't answered? Why aren't they answered in a way that stops them? Well, that's a huge question and always has been. Job is asking this question, and God does not answer him.
Yeah.
God instead says, know me and trust me. Realize and know that you're living in a fallen world, and the whole world, as John says, lies under the sway of the wicked one. Awful things happen in this time between the times. And a lot of times our response is going to be similar to Mary and Martha when Lazarus dies, and Jesus knows that Lazarus is sick. He doesn't come immediately. And when he does, Mary and Martha are saying, if you had been here, he wouldn't have died. I mean, that's a reasonable question and a legitimate question. What Jesus does is to weep. Jesus wept with them, and he's right there in the middle of all of that. And ultimately, he's raising Lazarus from the dead. Usually, we don't see God working as quickly as that. But we can know and trust that God is here and God is present. And even if we don't understand everything that's going on, and we won't. That's why part of what the Holy Spirit does in Romans 8 is to cause us to inwardly groan. Mm-hmm. And sometimes we don't even know what to pray for. And the Holy Spirit has to give us utterances, sometimes too deep for words.
Yeah.
And so I think the answer would be come to God in prayer and say, I'm having a hard time with understanding this, and I can't really understand it, but I need you to be present. Mm. And God responds to that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I love how you're drawing the parallels too. In the one instance, right, Jesus is not kind of engaging the emotional turmoil, right, with mm-hmm. render to Caesar what is Caesar's. On the other hand, he is also engaging in his friend's grief. And so I think yes. it's just so important to notice the emotional life of Jesus.
Well, yeah, and think about what Jesus says. I mean, this is one of the key things, I think, in the entire New Testament, is when Jesus says, Lazarus will be raised. And she says, I know that he will be raised at the resurrection. So she's saying, okay, you're giving me an answer, and you're giving me a theological answer, and I know that answer already. Essentially, I've been to Sunday school, is what she's yeah. saying. Jesus' response is, I am the resurrection mm-hmm. and the life. This isn't some abstraction. I am the resurrection standing in front of you right now and weeping with you right now and standing with you right yeah. now. And I think that sometimes when we reduce everything to the abstractions, we lose the fact of the presence of Jesus, mm-hmm. including in great suffering.
Yeah, that's true.
Ashley here. If you're looking for another podcast that features inspiring conversations with religious leaders, authors, and artists, then I recommend listening to the acclaimed podcast, No Small Endeavor. Produced by Great Feelings Studios and PRX, No Small Endeavor explores what it means to live a good life. Each episode, host Lee C. Camp sits down with special guests, like award-winning journalist and best-selling author Tim Alberta and civil rights hero Reverend James Lawson, to ask what it means to live a life worth living. You can even hear from Russell Moore on No Small Endeavor. If you're looking for somewhere to start, check out their new episode with Malcolm Gladwell, New York Times best-selling author and host of the wildly popular podcast Revisionist History. They explore how Malcolm became a stellar storyteller, some of the things he may or may not regret, and so much more. Don't miss out. Follow No Small Endeavor wherever you get your podcasts.
And here's another question from our listeners as we conclude. But as we think about the idea of forgiveness, this listener writes in and asks, how can we forgive someone without understanding? And so he mm-hmm. says, I've understood forgiveness, he feels, imperfectly as the release of an expectation from a transgressor. Mm-hmm. So stopping holding it against them. But now he says, I'm in a position of needing to forgive a dead man without understanding mm-hmm. what he did or how he could have done it, and no way really to ever reach clarity. So yeah. how does he begin that process of forgiveness when, reconciliation on this side of things is mm-hmm. is impossible? What does that look like?
Well, sometimes when people say forgiveness, what they mean by that is reconciliation. And a restoration to relationship with the person. And sometimes when if that's what you mean by forgiveness, then you're going to be, as this person is, in an impossible situation.
Yeah.
Either because the person is dead, or because the person is unrepentant, or because there has to be, in order for there to be justice, there has to be accountability that's happening. So forgiveness is not a lack of accountability at all. It's not cheap grace.
Right.
But often what we mean by forgiveness, I think, is in the New Testament when Paul says, quoting God, vengeance is mine. And so it's not that we say, oh, well, we don't want justice to be done. It's that we say ultimate justice will be done. And I trust God for that. Mm-hmm. And so in this case, you're never going to come to an understanding of why the person did the things that they did. You're never going to come to that understanding in this life. What you can do is to say, I'm not in a sense of desperation that justice will never be done. I instead really can trust God with that, which means that I can move on with my life. It doesn't mean that you're moving on, that you're not still hurt by what this person does. It doesn't even mean that it's not going to come to mind and you're going to grieve. Sometimes you're going to be angry. And a lot of times that anger is earned, not sinful, mm-hmm. but it's not going to have domination over you. Mm. And that would be, and again, we've talked about this before with other things, that takes time. So don't say to yourself, because I'm still grappling with this and I'm still wanting to understand it, that means that I'm an unforgiving person. No. Not necessarily. Mm-hmm. It may just mean that you're working through the hurt that you've experienced.
Right. Yeah. And I think it's just so helpful, right? Even that question, how it was worded is, how does one succeed, you know, and how does one understand? And maybe we won't actually see some of those answers at the moment as well.
Yeah. Well, I mean, if there are any of our listeners who haven't experienced anything like that, it's only because they're not paying attention. All of us,
right.
All of us are experiencing things where we say there's been suffering or there's mm-hmm. been hurt and I don't get it. I mean, that's why the Bible calls it the mystery of iniquity. Mm-hmm. And so if we get, and I'm the same way as this question, I am the same way. And what I want to do is to say, if I can just understand why this person is acting the way that they are, then I can kind of move forward. A lot of times you can't, you just can't figure it out. And you can nonetheless live a life that isn't in captivity to that.
Yes. Well, thank you for that hope. It's a pleasure to speak with you again and to answer listeners' questions.
Well, we would like to ask listeners, this has been an especially heavy show.
but there's
really
still hope. You've done well. Thank you.
Well, just want to let our listeners know, if you have a question about anything, and sometimes when people hear really heavy questions like this, they think, well, that means the question has to be big. No. Little questions, big questions, they're all welcome here. And so send them to questions@russellmoore.com, and I will do my best to answer them. You've been listening to The Russell Moore Show, brought to you by Christianity Today. Be sure to subscribe, send it to somebody that you think would benefit from it, and leave us a review wherever you listen to podcasts. And you can tap the show notes for more information, including how you can be a trial member with us here at Christianity Today. This is The Russell Moore Show. See you next time.
The Russell Moore Show is a production of Christianity Today. Eric Petrick is our chief creative officer. Russell Moore is the executive producer and our host. Mike Cosper is our director of podcasts. Administration for CT by Christine Kolb and Abby Perry. Production assistance by Core Media. Beth Grabencourt, coordinator. Kevin Duthu, producer and sound mixer. Our theme song is Dusty Delta Day by Lennon Hudden. If you like what you heard today, please consider subscribing so you don't miss any future episodes.